Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How does the brain form, process, and change memories over time? And what role do our feelings play in how we remember things? My guest today has spent his career exploring the mysteries of human memory, which after all makes us who we are as individuals, but is incredibly difficult to consciously control. James L. McGaw is director of the Center for the Neurobiology of Learning and Memory at the University of California at Irvine. He's the author of the book Memory and Emotion, The Making of Lasting Memories, and he'll be in town to speak tomorrow at the 2011 UT Dallas Neuroscience Conference hosted by the School of Behavioral and Brain Sciences. Dr. McGaw, welcome to Think.
Well, thank you very much.
Why are the processes of memory in particular so challenging to understand?
Well, it's complicated because memory is not memory. We have various forms of memory, each with their own characteristics and each with their own processes in the brain. So that we have very recent memory, the thing that allows us to carry on this conversation in which we capture information and use it instantly. We have information then over a longer period of time called long-term memory. We have the learning of skills. We have the learning of cognitive type of information and so on. And each of these kinds of information has a different substrate in the brain. And so you can't just say, oh, I'm going to study memory. You have to figure out the kind of memory that is being investigated.
Do memories physically change our brains?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Without the changes in the brain, there would be no memories. So that when some information comes in, the nervous system goes to work and processes occur, which ultimately lead to changes in the connections between the neurons in the brain at the area called synapses in the brain. And these processes then can be short-lasting or they can be long-lasting. And if they're long-lasting, then that would explain why it is that you can remember poems that you learned when you were a child and songs that you learned a long time ago and so on because of these lasting changes that take place in the brain.
And, of course, we don't need to remember everything. Recalling what I wore to work 3 weeks ago doesn't really help me in my day-to-day life today. How does the brain prioritize what stays with us and what we can let go?
Well, let me see. What you were wearing several weeks ago could be very important if there was some reason that you wanted to avoid wearing that today.
That's true.
That's some reason. And so one can never tell for any piece of information acquired whether it'll be useful in the future or not. And so we're pretty well organized to remember lots of things. That is, I could right now ask you about yesterday, tell me the events of the day, what happened, and you do a pretty good job of that, a surprisingly good job. However, and your point that you were making was a good one, if something happened that was particularly important by wearing that dress a few weeks ago, let's suppose that you were at a meeting and you tripped and you spilt some punch all over it right when you were supposed to meet a very important person.
That's a very realistic scenario, by the way.
Well, that would be embarrassing.
Yeah.
And then I think you would remember that dress probably forever, I would guess, because emotional arousal results in the creation of very strong and long-lasting memories, and that is the focus of my research, actually.
Yeah, and is that emotional? I mean, I suppose that in an evolutionary sense, we're doing well for ourselves. Is the things that really spark us to feel something very intensely are the things that we recall, because that could be danger. Am I correct?
Absolutely. That therein lies the evolutionary significance, because if it was something good, you want to remember it so you can get it again.
Right.
If it's something bad, you want to avoid it. So, you know, if our ancestors went to a creek to get a drink of water and there was a tiger there, they say, make mental note, don't go to that creek again at this time of the day.
Mm-hmm.
And if they went there and found delicious food and no tiger, they'd make mental note, this is a good place to go. And it raises the critically important point that we don't think a lot about, and that memories are not about the past. Memories are about the future. The function of memory is to guide our behavior in the future. And another important point is that memories are us. That is, the brain is the most complicated structure in the known universe. And from my perspective, I can make a good case that the major function of the brain is to produce memories. Because if we don't produce memories, we can't do anything else. Because it's so critical to making plans for the future for survival. So memory is the key to human evolution and to our own individual successes.
So, Dr. McGill, imagine that I am my evolutionary great-great-great-grandmother, and I remember finding a patch of raspberries and no tiger. Am I remembering, you know, a year later, do I remember the event itself, or do I remember my most recent memory of the event?
Both. Mm-hmm. Both. Because we do lay down these memories. Let's take a very important event. Let's say learning about when Osama bin Laden was killed. Mm-hmm. I think that's the latest example of an event that most of us will remember, and most of us will remember where we were when we learned about that. So we'll hold that information as we did 9/11, and as we hold embarrassments, and we hold little automobile accidents and things of that kind. Those things are there. But as we recall that over time, every time we recall it, that's new information added to the old information, and it gets changed a little bit. And so when we recall something of the very distant past, the odds are that we're not having a pure recollection, but we're having a recollection which is biased by the recollecting events that have occurred over time. Now, it could be, and I think it is the case, that we have many experiences that we don't rehearse very much because there's no reason for rehearsing them. There's no particularly significant significance to them. And then we are reminded of them as a much later time. And those can be relatively pure. Those are autobiographical remembering events. So we have both kinds. We have the kinds that can be relatively pure because they haven't been fiddled with for a long period of time, and the ones that have been remembered again and again and again and again. Do you remember the time, you know, and families sit around and tell the stories? And these stories then become the events to be remembered.
Yeah, sure. Well, you know, when you talk about things like, you know, the death of Osama bin Laden and 9/11, and if you want to go back, the Kennedy assassination, those are an interesting category because many of us remember them even though we did not directly experience what took place. Are our memories reinforced externally in those cases?
Well, sure. Most of us know that George Washington was the first president of the United States, and we didn't witness that event.
Right.
And yet we hold that, and that is that's one kind of information that we have in the brain, which is just information about the world. And then we have another kind of information which is based on our own experiences of that. We may remember Osama bin Laden's acceptance speech, or the speech that he gave after he was elected, because we might have seen it on TV. And those are very different. In one case, those are autobiographical remembrances of things that we have experienced, and the other is just information that we have acquired that other people have provided. But one could remember when we learned a fact. For example, nobody witnessed that I know of the death of Marilyn Monroe, and yet many of us remember the fact that Marilyn Monroe died because we get it from news sources and so on.
Of course, there are huge advantages to remembering things that are associated with strong emotions. On the other hand, they can be really troublesome. I'm thinking here about people who've experienced post-traumatic stress disorder.
Sure.
Have we made any progress in helping people forget things that are not doing them any favors in the present?
Well, I think that's controversial. The answer is yes, but with big qualifications.
Mm-hmm.
The best evidence is that cognitive therapy does work to some extent, and that is teaching people explicitly that things that they thought were distressing and dangerous are now no longer distressing and dangerous. That is explicitly training them that this information has changed, and that is being used rather effectively in treatment of post-traumatic stress disorder. They're even using virtual reality, so that the people who are affected put on goggles and they're able to walk around Iraq with no bombs going off rather than with bombs going off. so that people can come to understand circumstances that thought were dangerous and troubling them are really not that bad after all. So it's retraining the brain. So that's one approach. The other approach is related to my own work, and that is a pharmacological approach. And I guess I would have to give some background to my own research to explain that. May I do that?
Please do, yeah.
All right. In a very large number of studies, my research group and I determined that when we get excited about something, we release adrenaline. I think we all know that. We talk about an adrenaline moment. We get excited, and adrenaline is released from the central part of the adrenal gland and grows into the bloodstream and then has effects on the brain. We also release cortisol from the outer bark of the adrenal gland a little bit later, about 15 minutes later. So these two stress hormones are released, and they're released even with mild excitement. If somebody said to you, just, well, you know, that was a very interesting interview, but, you know, you said some stupid things.
Mm-hmm.
You wouldn't like that, and you would be embarrassed about it, and you would remember that.
Hmm.
If they said that, you could not help it. You would release adrenaline, and you would release cortisol, and those would go to the brain, have effects on the brain, which would result in influencing the release of a particular substance called norepinephrine. It's a chemical substance, a transmitter in the brain, and it acts in a very specific region of the brain called the amygdala, which is Greek for almond, because it's an almond-shaped structure, which is in the medial part of the temporal lobes of our brains. So here, adrenaline and cortisol get pumped out when we get excited about something. We get embarrassed, we get shocked, we get rewarded or something, and that happens. Then norepinephrine gets released in that region of the brain. Then that region of the brain, the amygdala, is in communication with the regions of the brain where information is being processed. And it says, in effect, hey, folks, I got turned on. Make a stronger memory.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So the work that we've been doing, work in my laboratory, including a lot of it was done by Krista McIntyre, who's a professor at the University of Texas, Dallas, where I'll be speaking tomorrow at a conference. She did some of this work, showing that activation of the amygdala leads to very specific changes within another region of the brain called the hippocampus, which is involved in storing information. So now, if that is the case, that's the process by which memories are formed. You have epinephrine release. It takes time for that to occur, and then it influences the formation of memories in other brain regions. What would happen if you gave a drug that prevented the action of adrenaline and norepinephrine?
Hmm.
And there is such a drug. It's a beta blocker. We'll do that. One of the most commonly used drugs ever for the treatment of high blood pressure. Propranolol is one of the drugs, and we've used that extensively. Well, a psychiatrist at Harvard University named Roger Pittman learned about our work and said, well, if this is the case, that strong memories are made by the action of adrenaline and norepinephrine, and those strong memories are prevented by propranolol, and we had shown that in studies with rats and also with humans, then he said, what if I should give this drug to people who've recently been traumatized? And so he did.
Hmm.
So he got individuals who had been assaulted and injured in the Boston area and was able to put them on a beta blocker drug, propranolol, shortly after they had been traumatized, within 2 hours.
And excuse me for interrupting. Am I correct about this, that your research has also shown that strong memories are, in fact, most susceptible to disruption soon after they've occurred?
Yes, soon afterwards. Soon afterwards, because memories are being made during a short period of time after learning occurs.
Hmm.
And so he had to get that drug into them as quickly as he could, and he did. It's within 2 hours, which is not the best. It should be within 5 minutes. But in any case, he then examined them for signs of post-traumatic stress disorder 2 months later and found that the drug did, in fact, produce some slight reduction in the signs of post-traumatic stress disorder. That study was replicated by a French group, And so at least there is some evidence that post-traumatic stress disorder can be prevented by treatments that are given shortly after learning of traumatic experiences.
Does emotion also play into our ability and our tendency to recall particular memories?
Well, sure. Because the emotion can produce a particular state, and under that state, you may be more likely to recall memories that were formed under that particular state. If you're frightened, you may recall events of the past that frightened you. If you're angered, you may recall events that angered you. So that is state-related, emotional state-related remembering. If you're in a very reflective mood and it's a nice day, you may remember other nice days that you've had in the past. Yes, that certainly happens.
Let's go to the phones now. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. My guest this hour is James L. McGaw, author of Memory and Emotion, The Making of Lasting Memories. He's director of the Center for the Neurobiology of Learning and Memory at the University of California at Irvine, and he'll speak tomorrow at the UT Dallas Neuroscience Conference. We have on the line now Maggie in Fort Worth. Hi, Maggie.
Hello. Interesting topic. It reminds me, pardon the pun, I guess, of something I noted a couple days ago about photography. And I do a lot of photography, and I noticed that if I don't have a camera and I'm just looking at something, I remember it better as an organic event than if I'm photographing it and filtering it through the film. I remember what I see in the camera or in the photos later, but they don't seem as powerful. And I'm just wondering, you talked about the process and the chemicals and all. Is the brain recognizing the camera as something and it doesn't need to give as many chemical shots to remember?
Interesting question. Thanks, Maggie.
Well, I don't know the answer to that. All I know is that we tend to remember the things that we focus on. And so if the focus is on making a picture, then the climate of the day and the smells of the day and the social context may not be as important.
I'm curious about memory and learning for a skill like typing. So I learned to type when I was about 16, and for a while I had to think very hard about where each finger went. And now when I type, I almost couldn't tell you where any of the keys are located on the keyboard. What processes are at play there?
Well, that's right. That's one of the oldest questions that's been addressed in the science of learning and memory. And that is the difference between skills or habits and learning a cognitive information. These are very different things. So when you get in a car, when you're first learning to drive, it's a horrific thing because there's so many things to do, and later on you just drive.
Yeah.
And when you first picked up a typewriter or a cell phone or whatever, it was horrific trying to discover where all the letters are and what the sequences were and so on. And now it's just automatic. You sit down and you think and the fingers do the job. Well, that's a form of learning which is different from your learning about the knowledge that there is ability to type.
Hmm.
And that's controlled by regions of the brain that are very different from your knowledge that you are doing something. The regions of the brain that handle that are called the striatum, which are in the middle of the brain, includes the caudate nucleus and a region called the putamen and some other regions. And those are the regions that are significantly involved in the acquisition of learning of skills. We have actually studied that, and we've showed that the same drugs which will influence the formation of cognitive memories of, about the facts of things, will also influence the learning of the skills that are involved.
So are enhancement drugs on the horizon?
Well, they're always on the horizon. You know, it's sort of like they say that Brazil is a country of the future and always will be. cognitive enhancing drugs are drugs of the future and always will be. And why is that the case? Well, first of all, attempts to find such drugs for humans has been going on for several decades now, and not a single drug has been approved for memory enhancement for use of the general public. All we have are a few drugs that are only modestly effective for improving cognitive functioning in people with dementia, with disorder such as Alzheimer's disease and other diseases that result in dementia. Those drugs are only very modestly effective, and certainly they're not drugs that anyone else would probably want to take unless they had dementia.
Hmm.
It's just turned out to be a horrendously difficult task for the pharmaceutical companies, and there are lots of reasons for that. Lots of the drugs that have been developed have very awful side effects. D-amphetamine, for example, is a memory-enhancing drug both in animals and humans, but it is terribly addictive. So why would you want to take a drug to improve memory and pay the price of becoming forever addicted to the drug?
I'm going to jump in now. We have to take a quick break. Yes. My guest is James L. McGaw, director of the Center for the Neurobiology of Learning and Memory at UC Irvine. He'll be in town to speak tomorrow at UT Dallas. If you'd like to call in, you can call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for THINK comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to THINK on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is James L. McGaw. He's director of the Center for the Neurobiology of Learning and Memory at the University of California at Irvine and author of the 2006 book Memory and Emotion, The Making of Lasting Memories. He'll be speaking tomorrow at the 2011 UT Dallas Neuroscience Conference hosted by the School of Behavioral and Brain Sciences. You can find a link to more information on the THINK page of KERA.org. If you'd like to join the conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372. So, Dr. McGaw, as someone who has to study daily to prepare for my show, and of course there are a lot of students out there, when we study for something, typically we put ourselves in the most emotion-free, distraction-free environment possible. Is that actually hindering our ability to retain what we're trying to learn?
It's probably not a good idea.
Hmm.
From everything that we have learned over the past decades, several decades, a little emotion is a good thing.
Huh.
A little emotion is a good thing. And the truth is, students know that. I know that as a former student. I know that even now as a professor. And I should point out, I'm also a visiting scholar at University of Texas, Dallas School of Behavioral and Brain Sciences. So I do some studying there, too, also.
Mm-hmm.
But students know that if they open the chapter that they haven't read before, and they start to read, and it's 11 o'clock at night, they read a little while and then go several pages and realize they haven't learned anything.
Right.
Go back and read it again. And that's about the worst possible way to investigate anything. Now, in your case, you know that you're getting ready for something which is going to occur pretty quickly, and you've got to get it right. So it's not boring for you. I mean, I would claim that it's not. I would claim
no, it
that,
never is. It's always exciting.
I would claim that you're very interested in it, excited about it, emotionally involved in it, and so you're going to get that information.
Hmm.
Students may not have that same attitude. If they're taking a required course in organic chemistry just because it's part of the requirement, and they start by just opening the book and starting to read it, it's almost guaranteed that they're going to fall asleep.
Hmm.
It's also guaranteed that when they pick it up the next day, they're not going to remember having read it the previous day because it just was not anything that was exciting. And the way to solve that problem is for people to ask themselves, what are the questions that I really need to find an answer to? You know, when people go to Google, they just don't go to Google and say, I wonder what I'll find in Google. What they say is, I have a very specific question I'm going to ask of Google, and then I'll see if I can get an answer to it. And that's the approach that should be taken to the learning of information, whether it's in school or college or in life.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Gene in Fort Worth. Hey, Gene.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just had a quick question about beta blockers. I've been on a beta blocker for a number of years for prevention of migraine, but also noticed that having some issues with short-term memory, and I just thought that was hilarious because I guess my question is how long? What about people who've been on beta blockers, low dose for years, and memory? I don't know if you can comment on that or.
Yeah, well, there've actually been quite a few studies of that, and for low doses. And it also depends on the beta blocker you're on. But for low doses, the effects are not large, and in many cases not there at all. It would take a pretty high dose of a beta blocker to have a memory-reducing effect. It also would, as I said, depend upon the specific beta blockers, because some go directly into the brain, and some of them do not enter the brain. And if they don't enter the brain and don't have big effects in the periphery, then they're not going to have those central effects that will influence memory.
Why is it that memories that we form early in life really seem to stick with us in a way that even similarly intense experiences later in life don't?
Well, they may or may not. There is a peculiar finding that nobody's been able to explain, and that is, although the first 3 years of life are arguably the most important years of our life to form all of our, we learn how to walk, we learn how to talk, and so on, we have pitifully few memories of anything that occurred during those first 3 years. Mm-hmm. So although lots of very important things happen, we just don't recall them. It's called infantile amnesia, about which we know very, very little. Now, if you go beyond that, then we have childhood memories that are pretty strongly experienced and well-remembered, and in part that could be because those are unique experiences. It may be the first time you got a dog.
Mm-hmm.
It may be the first time you played in a piano recital, and so on. And so they stand out as unique events. But as we go along in life, so much of what we do in our work and our daily experience is repetitive. And so being able to single out any event of a particular day as being more strongly remembered or more poorly remembered is unlikely, unless it's something special and especially emotionally arousing.
We have an email here from Bill who writes, I just had a giant aha moment. Certain media outlets use very excited or an inflammatory language, often presented with strong emotion, perhaps shouting or crying. Typically, these outlets present a strong and clear message with little ambiguity. Perhaps the emotional response of the consumers of that media forms strong memories of the message due to the hormones released when they were exposed to intense emotion. What do you think about that?
That's probably right, and I think this, although they don't know it, that's probably why they're doing it. They want to say something that will stick, and so in some cases they use actually inflammatory words, and we know who those people are because they're on radio and they're on TV, and I think it's most unfortunate because the kind of information imparted is typically related to the intensity of the presentation. That is, the value of it is not related to it.
Mm-hmm.
But the effect is there, so that and also advertisers use it also. They try to get the information across in an emotionally exciting way so that that information will stick. And very often it does, and very often it sells products.
I'm curious about this, and I did not see it in your book, so forgive me if it's completely outside your realm of expertise, but sometimes I listen to books on tape when I'm walking for exercise, and when I'm walking in the same location, I can remember exactly what was on the MP3 at that time. Is there an association between place and learning?
Oh, yes. That's a very big deal. The region of the brain that is essential for calculating spatial relationships is the hippocampus, and that's in the medial part of the temporal lobe of the human brain. And that is the same region which does calculations of information. That is, when you and I are communicating at the present time, we are using the hippocampus extensively to do that. But the hippocampus is also at this moment processing the space in which we're located, where you are in the room, and so on. So it's not a surprise that those two things would occur at the same time.
So that might be a good way to study.
Oh, yes, sure.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Plano and speak with Philip. Hi, Philip.
Hi there. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
This is a fascinating subject. I've got a question about perhaps the decreasing need for memory. We have information, all the information in the world at our fingertips. So instead of studying, for instance, the divisions of the brain and the regions of the brain, I could just look it up temporarily and then forget it. And I'm wondering if you've done any research on whether that is actually happening. Is our ability to remember actually decreasing because of increased technology? Thank you very much.
Thanks for your call.
Well, as I was listening to it, I was drawing a slightly different conclusion. I don't think that our ability to remember is going down. I think the brain just does that. It's just an automatic processing of the brain. But I think what may be happening is the decreased storage of information because we don't think we have to know it. For example, as a child, I had to learn all of the presidents of the United States up until that time. Now, children don't have to learn that because they just can open up their cell phones and get that information instantaneously. So there is an increased reliance on these electronic gadgets, and that may in the long run decrease the kind of information that is stored in our brains that we need for survival. That is entirely something that is possible. I don't know how much thought has been given to that. I do know that I worry about it when I'm teaching because I wonder whether the students even need to worry about what I'm saying or what they're reading, because if they need to have it at any moment, they can just get on their cell phone and get the information. By the way, we can't be assured that the information will be accurate, however.
Yeah.
I mean, if they go to Wikipedia, for example, for information, we know that there is a high likelihood that that will not be accurate. But at any rate, your point is correct. We are relying increasingly on these gadgets as the source of our information rather than our own brains at the source of information.
I have to imagine, though, that a certain kind of higher order thinking requires us to already have this information in our brains in order to synthesize things.
Well, you're probably right. You're probably right. On the other hand, we do make reference to things that we know are there and pull it in. I do that as a professor. When I'm writing, I'll turn to sources that I know are there and I need to have, and I'll get that information. I mean, it's not a Google-type thing. It means I can go to a primary source, mm-hmm. which I can also get via the Internet. I'm not sure about that. I'm not sure.
Let's go next on the phone to Saad in Dallas. Hi, Saad.
Hi, how are you doing?
Thank Very
you
well,
for
thanks.
Taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, I got maybe two questions. The first one is about dreams. Like, where do the dreams, how our brain choose, like, what dreams for us to see, you know? And if there's any way, like, we can control what dream to dream about, you know? And then another question, I don't know if you have time for it or not, it's about lie detectors.
Well, let's get to the dreams question because we're starting to run out of time, Saad, and I want to make sure that we at least can answer this one fully.
Dreams are strange things. We don't have too much control over them. Although it is a case that we will very often dream about things that we have learned the preceding day, in particular just before we went to sleep. It also is the case that if you learn something and go to sleep, you're much more likely to remember that than if you learn something and stay awake. And that is because during sleep, there is processing of that information, which leads to its strengthening. That's a very active research at the present time. And the effects of sleep depend upon the stages of sleep. That is, we go through different stages of sleep as we go through the night, and the processes that go on in our brain during the night have an effect on strengthening the memories that were formed just prior to going to sleep. So sleep turns out to be an important part of the memory story.
Why is repetition so good for remembering things?
Because you're putting that information in again and again and again. And either you are strengthening the same structure or you're putting more in so that you have greater access to it. Those are two hypotheses about that. Let me run through that again. In one case, you're just making it stronger, the memory stronger, stronger, and stronger. So you say you want to memorize a series of digits of a telephone number, and you repeat that over and over and over again. And one hypothesis is that you're activating the same processes in the brain and just making stronger and stronger connections between the nerve cells that are holding that information, like glue, making strong glue between them. Another hypothesis is that you're not doing that, but you're putting more and more copies in so that your probability of finding them goes up. In any case, repetition, particularly rehearsal. It's not just repetition, but it's rehearsal. The act of rehearsing information strengthens it. There's a psychologist named Dr. Rodiger at Washington University in St. Louis who has done extensive research on this, showing that the act of rehearsing strengthens memory much more strongly than just the act of passive repetition.
Any ideas at all about these rogue memories that don't seem to be associated with anything important but that come to us time and time again?
Well, I guess I don't, because I'd have to have an example of that, too.
I don't know. Sometimes you'll think back to something in your childhood when you were playing with a deck of cards or something, and there's nothing special about the memory at all.
Well, I would say that there's probably some cue at the time that evoked that particular memory. There's something about the circumstances of the present time that reached into your brain and called out this information. I mean, it's also possible that the brain just is firing away and once in a while random things come out, but I don't think that's as likely. I think most of the things that come out are evoked by experiences that you're having at the present.
James L. McGaugh is director of the Center for the Neurobiology of Learning and Memory at UC Irvine. He's the author of Memory and Emotion, The Making of Lasting Memories. He'll speak tomorrow at the 2011 UT Dallas Neuroscience Conference hosted by the School of Behavioral and Brain Sciences. Dr. McGaugh, it's been a fascinating hour. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.